Good morning. My name is Dina Hurwitz, and on behalf of the Law School Human Rights Program, I would like to welcome all of you to this program on strategies for transitional justice in Syria. We are delighted to have with us two individuals whose significant knowledge and experience with the conflict in Syria would be enlightening just for its contextual foundations and what they know. But we wanted more than an account of the violations and the horrors of this people's revolution turned bloodbath. Rather, we wanted a discussion that considers the means and methods being applied today while the conflict is raging to lay the groundwork for the transition to a society that will be based on peace, justice, participatory democracy, and the rule of law. Certainly after 3 years of fighting in Syria and countless violations of international criminal, human rights, and humanitarian law by all sides, prospects for peace and options for transitional justice are hard to fathom. Transitional justice is most generally understood as methods to reconcile society and address the legacy of heinous acts that have taken place within their borders. It's focused on reordering society to promote a more just, less repressive society that seeks to overcome past trauma and account for past injustice. These methods include judicial and non-judicial options that fall more or less into four areas: truth-seeking and reconciliation, reparations and memorialization, prosecutions and judicial processes, and institutional reform. Both of our speakers are integrally involved in organizations that work not just in the post-conflict transition, but more importantly, before and during the conflict, to document and preserve evidence and lay the foundations for transitional justice processes to operate without hesitation when the time is right. In April 2012, the group of Friends of the Syrian People envisioned the Syrian Justice and Accountability Center, or SJAC, to promote justice and accountability in Syria through ensuring that all violations of international criminal, humanitarian, and human rights law are documented, that civil society and other relevant actors work effectively together, and that data and expertise are available to serve as a deterrent to continuing abuses and for future accountability and transitional justice efforts. SJAC conducts research to better understand Syrian opinions and perspectives, provides expertise and resources, conducts awareness-raising activities, contributes to the development of locally appropriate transitional justice and accountability mechanisms. The SJAC is an independent, non-political, Syrian-led, and multilaterally supported organization with political and or financial support from 40 countries and organizations. Mohammed Al-Abdallah is executive director of SJAC. He's a Syrian human rights and democracy researcher and activist. He received his bachelor's of law from Lebanese University in 2007. He's a freelance journalist, contributes to several Arabic newspapers, and he previously worked as a research assistant for Human Rights Watch in Beirut from July 2007 to January 2009, where he covered Syria. Mohammed is a former political prisoner who was imprisoned in Syria on two separate occasions for his work defending human rights and lobbying for political reform. He moved to the United States, in fact, to Oklahoma City, where he was resettled.
That's the United States, though.
In February 2009, where he was granted political asylum. Mohammed has been involved in the Syrian revolution since its early weeks in Daraa and became one of the revolution's most well-known media faces outside of Syria. He's one of Syria's early observers of human rights violations, including observing the Supreme State Security Court, internet freedom in Syria, and documenting and reporting on cases of torture and ill treatment. He's traveled extensively since the conflict began to put the Syrian revolution on the agenda of high-level political and human rights actors. And I learned this morning he just passed his citizenship exam, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Human Rights Watch considers international justice, accountability for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity to be an essential element of building respect for human rights. They engage to actively engage with the work of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and other international tribunals as well, as well as the efforts of national courts, including in Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Bosnia, to bring perpetrators of the worst crimes to justice. Human Rights Watch also supports the efforts of national courts to use their domestic laws to try those charged with serious crimes in violation of international law, regardless of where the crimes occurred. Balkis Jara is counsel in the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, where she has worked for the past 4 years, focusing on the Middle East and North Africa region. She was born and grew up in Libya. She lived in the United States and Canada and holds Canadian citizenship. Balkis holds degrees in common law and civil law from McGill University and a master's from the University of Oxford. She's a former law clerk at the Federal Court of Canada and has worked at the Brookings Institution, supporting the mandate of the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons. So each of our speakers will have 15 to 20 minutes, after which we will open the floor for questions and discussion. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Can I start?
Sure. So thank you to the UVA Law School and in particular to Dina Hurwitz for putting together and hosting a panel on an issue which often doesn't get enough attention in the public domain, but which is so critical. And thank you, all of you, for coming today and for your interest in Syria. Today I thought I'd start off briefly telling you a little bit about how we do our work at Human Rights Watch and how international justice fits into that. And next, I wanted to outline Human Rights Watch's position on accountability and lay out our view regarding what concrete measures we believe would contribute to credible criminal prosecutions for abuses in Syria. So I'm talking about one of the strands that Dina referred to, criminal justice. And then finally, if there's time at the end, and we can do that in the Q&A, I'll highlight a couple of steps that can be taken now to help prepare the Syrian justice system for any future trials. So let me start off with a few words about Human Rights Watch's methodology, and which at the same time will give you a sense of the types of crimes that are occurring in Syria today and hopefully put my remarks in context. So we conceive of our work generally under the rubric of 1, investigate, 2, expose, and 3, change. So what do I mean by that? Investigate is essentially our researchers going on the ground, conducting investigations of and documenting human rights abuses. During an emergency situation like the one that we are faced with in Syria, where there's a conflict, our researchers really attempt to do that very quickly and as thoroughly as possible, and that involves talking to witnesses of the abuses, victims, and sometimes the perpetrators themselves. But our goal with any research mission is to gain as accurate a picture as we can of the situation. And that's particularly important in a situation like Syria, where you may have a propaganda war where different sides are trying to paint a different picture of the narrative of events that are taking place there. So the next step is to expose that information and make it public and use it to challenge those who are in a position to do something about it, which essentially means stopping the violation and providing some kind of redress. So taking that raw material, analyzing it, reviewing it, and putting it into a product, making it public, translating it into different languages, and distributing it to the media, diplomats, state officials, and so on. And that all culminates at the end in intense advocacy efforts, where we are trying to move local actors and international actors to influence some kind of change. And it's at that stage that I think I would situate our international justice work. But let's apply that to the Syria situation and with that rubric in mind. As you all know, some very serious crimes have been committed in Syria and on a very vast scale. And I just want to give you a sense of the situation from our perspective of what we're seeing, what we're documenting. One of the important things to understand about the situation in Syria is that the Assad government is fighting not simply the combatants on the other side, but a major part of their war strategy is to attack civilians. Civilians who happen to be living in opposition-held territory. And there's a clear rationale for doing that. It's a classic counterinsurgency strategy. It involves draining the sea to get to the fish. So if you make life miserable enough for the people living there, if you kill enough of them, they're going to flee. And there are advantages to that flight. The rebels will find it harder to hide among the civilian population, and they won't have a productive economy from which to buy their supplies. Of the roughly 150,000, I think, Syrians that have lost their lives to date, about 40% of those are civilians. And so the Assad government is using a variety of means to attack the civilians. The most notorious of those incidents was the chemical weapons attack that took place last August, which I'm sure you all know about, and that killed 1,000 people in just one night. The Syrian government denied responsibility for it. We at Human Rights Watch conducted our own investigation and found that the evidence strongly suggested that the government was responsible. And again, we were talking to witnesses, we were reviewing the medical evidence, we were looking at the actual rockets that were used, what the potential source of those rockets were. Just to say that while that attack is obviously awful, it represented a very, let's say, low percentage of the civilians that have died over the last 3 years. Most have actually died at the hands of conventional weapons. It's not just attacks with weapons, but another part of the strategy is to deprive the civilian population of their basic necessities. And some areas are completely besieged. No food is coming in, no medicine is coming in, and the civilians themselves aren't able to go out. And the government has made sure that humanitarian aid it'll be very hard to reach those areas. Just to give you an idea, one of the stipulations that the government has made is that the aid has to come through a government-controlled area, which means that if I am a displaced Syrian and I happen to be very close to an opposition-held area where it would take 10 minutes for a convoy to go through, I would have to wait maybe weeks for those convoys to go around through government territory. And that's the kind of work we're also documenting. We're in those displaced persons camps. We're seeing the effect that those kinds of policies and that kind of strategy is having on civilians. I don't want to pretend that everything is wonderful on the other side, because it certainly isn't. There are also some opposition groups that are committing atrocities as well. So I don't want to sugarcoat that. The extremist element is certainly gaining ground in Syria, and we are doing work to document those abuses as well. And part of our work is to look at abuses on all sides, and we try to work as impartially as possible. So that brings us to the change part of the rubric I was talking to you about. So what do we do given all of this? Part of it is putting pressure on the Syrian government and also on the opposition groups that are committing these crimes. But much of the pressure that remains to be put on both these sides would require action by the UN Security Council. And unfortunately, the political dynamics are such now that Russia, backed by China, has been threatening to veto any escalation of sanctions by the Security Council, including on accountability and criminal justice, which is what I want to focus on. Because given the gravity and the scale of the crimes that we've documented, and others, frankly, we absolutely need to be talking about justice. And as I mentioned, because a lot of sides are implicated here, we want to see individuals held to account, no matter their political allegiance. So one of the big questions under discussion right now is what mechanism should be considered as we contemplate the possibility of criminal prosecutions. Normally, the starting place would be at the national courts because they're the first, or they should be, the first line of defense for victims to ensure justice. Here, I should say at the outset that it's our view at Human Rights Watch that national prosecutions in Syria are just not an option right now. Not only has the Syrian government demonstrated a complete lack of political will to ensure credible justice for past abuses, also ongoing abuses, but there are also serious concerns about whether the judicial system really has the capacity to address the mass scale of crimes that we're witnessing in Syria today. Just a brief word on political will. The political will to ensure, when I say credible prosecutions, I mean that they are impartial and that they are independent. It's often in short supply in places like Syria, where there has been an armed conflict or where there's been an extreme intense period of violence. So it's not unique to Syria, particularly where persons who are in powerful positions or those to them close to those in power are implicated in the abuses. You can see why they wouldn't want to see an independent process. But even before the conflict, and Mohammed, you can correct me, but I think it's fair to say that the domestic system lacked independence and wasn't free from political control. We know that there are laws on the books still right now that immunize members of the security forces in Syria. So it's against that background that we have been urging the UN Security Council to give the International Criminal Court a mandate to examine crimes in Syria. And just to pause here for a moment so that you understand why is the Security Council involved. The ICC was set up through a treaty, but Syria isn't a party to that treaty. So the only way that the court could gain jurisdiction over crimes in Syria is for the Security Council to give it jurisdiction. It's laid out in the court's statute that the Security Council has the power to do that. And it's done it in other instances, and we can talk about that in the Q&A as well. So that's a large part of my work, is advocacy on this issue. And we believe that the ICC's involvement would have a real impact, first in the ongoing, during the ongoing conflict. We feel that the credible threat of prosecution through the ICC may help to deter future abuses. And looking forward in a post-conflict period, we feel the court would set a valuable reference point for other judicial mechanisms, including national prosecutions. We don't make this proposition naively because, as I said, the Russians are most likely to be a big obstacle to that. But we also don't see that as an irreversible situation for no other reason than that we feel that there hasn't been enough pressure put on Russia to change its stance on the court. In our work, you know, we've really underlined the point that you need a global coalition of countries to stand behind this measure and really pressure Russia, including from the Security Council itself, members of the Security Council itself. So just to give you an idea of what that means, about a year ago, Switzerland submitted a letter to the Security Council, and 60 countries, about 60 countries from around the world, signed that letter, and essentially it was asking the Council to give the ICC a mandate in Syria. And we were, behind that effort, helping to get countries around the world to sign up to that letter. Unfortunately, you know, the response has been silence from the Security Council, but we really saw that as a first step in our advocacy in what is an uphill battle. But just to say, there are 15 members on the Security Council, and 9 of them support this initiative. So we went from 0 to having 9 on the council, which I think is quite significant. And I just wanted to spend some time on the U.S. here, because we're in the United States. We're at an American law school. They're one of the more powerful potential proponents of the court's involvement in Syria, but they haven't pushed for a role of the court. For the court. They haven't said no, they haven't said yes either. So that's another element of our work, is to draw that out and really press countries like the United States that would have some influence to come out and support. There are a number of reasons why the Obama administration hasn't. First, from what we hear, they believe it would be a vain effort because the Russians would most likely veto it. But again, our position and the argument that we've been making is that isn't a reason not to take a principled stance. If anything, the United States coming out in support of such a measure would really signal that accountability and criminal justice needs to be concretely on the agenda for Syria, and it would show that the United States is a supporter of impartial justice. The United States, by the way, is working maybe to set up an ad hoc court for Syria. I won't get into that now, but we can certainly talk about that in the Q&A. Just to say, you know, Russia is often used as the stumbling block. Well, why bother trying this? Because they're just going to stop it. We have seen actually some breakthroughs on Syria at the Security Council. The first had to do with the chemical weapons accord. The second having to do with humanitarian access. There was a resolution passed just, I guess, a month ago, and it was unanimous. And so you could see that a situation where developments on the ground change such that Russia's calculation changes as well. And then one other point to make is that some feel that the United States is reluctant to talk about the ICC because it may be a stumbling block to the peace, the on-again, off-again peace negotiations that are currently stalled, as far as I know. But in our experience and part of the research that we've done and drawing from that, we've actually seen that criminal indictments for senior political, military, rebel leaders can actually help peace processes by stigmatizing and marginalizing those bad actors that are actually standing in the way of a conflict's resolution. So I just want to come back, you know, I've spent time on the ICC and I'm happy to take your questions on that, but just to say that it's not a comprehensive solution to the state of impunity that we see in Syria, but we feel that it's a start and it's a step in the right direction. Even if the ICC was somehow brought into the picture tomorrow, I think there is broad recognition that because of the many crimes that have been committed in Syria, that the court can't handle it alone. In fact, it's only going to be able to do a few cases. And you can see that from the other investigations that are going on at the court now. But again, I come back to that point that I think we can agree that at least in the near term, we can't really rely on the national system to do it. And even in a immediately post-conflict situation, I think it would be unrealistic. So while strengthening and revitalizing the national system, you know, if and when the circumstances allow for that, is going to be necessary, and it's an essential goal, it's going to be a very long-term goal. And so I think while, the goal is there, we have to be very realistic about how to achieve it. I just want to stop here. I can speak at the Q&A about what, you know, because I've left you basically in barren land. There's no ICC referral. There's no immediate prospect for an ICC referral. I'm also telling you their national courts can't do it. So what can be done in the interim to fill that vacuum? Are there any alternatives? So I'm happy to talk about that. And before I turn it over to Mohammed, just to emphasize again that I am focused on criminal prosecutions, but that's certainly not the only element of an accountability process. Dina mentioned truth-telling, reparations, institutional reform. Those are all very important elements that are going to be important in moving Syrian society forward. We don't see them as a substitute for criminal prosecutions, but an important complement. And I hope Mohammed can speak to that.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor. And thanks all for coming. It's the first time, actually, a few times, to see somebody who focused on the narrowly in the criminal, individual criminal justice to talk about the other alternatives, because to most of the practitioners in the international criminal justice, they like prosecution. They just want to go behind the perpetrators, because that's the best way of justice or the best path of justice. But thank you for recognizing that. And I want to pick from the ICC one comment. I was 2 years ago on the radio in Washington with Ambassador Theodore Katouf, the U.S. ambassador to Syria in 2003-04-05, where somebody called the show and asked about the ICC, why we don't have a referral to the ICC. And then I answered, because Syria is not part of Rome Statute and the Security Council is blocked by Russia and China. And then Ambassador Katouf said, let me tell you a good story. I was ambassador there, and Bush administration called me, say, go talk to the Syrian government, discourage them, tell them no to the ICC, and tell them not to join. And I did a good job, and I convinced the Syrian government not to do it. So that's part of the efforts that the U.S. put at the beginning to block the ICC, because two wars or three wars, lots of crimes or violations, alleged violations committed there, and that will be a threatening mechanism to any international power to see independent international mechanism of justice being set up to hold everybody accountable, basically. So I want to talk a little bit about what we do in the Syria Justice and Accountability Center. We started almost a year and a half ago, but the vision was more to talk about ideas from the coalition, Friends of Syria Coalition, who is the international coalition of countries that support the Syrian opposition and support the people in Syria, to find a way for the justice in Syria. And their version of the justice was exactly the criminal justice version of justice. They just want to think about documenting for preparing cases for any tribunal, international tribunal, ICC, or even the national prosecutor at domestic level in Syria. What we've been doing in developing our strategy, we thought we will be doing two things, and that's what we've been doing. One is documenting everything. So similar investigation and documentation that Human Rights Watch and other groups engaged in, except that we do not expose anyone, so we don't do advocacy work out of these reports, and we do not try to change any behavior of perpetrators. We're documenting everything and try to preserve everything for the moment when the justice or the accountability mechanism will start. And the reason behind that is there's enough advocacy organization doing their work, and there's a previous precedent in Syria in the 1982s, the government had a big fighting with the Muslim Brotherhood in the city of Hama, where the government launched missiles in the city, used air jets against the city, and killed 40,000 people. And that was gone, with no accountability. So there is a history of impunity inside the government head, and that's the government giving the government more courage to do what they're doing today, because we did it 3 decades ago, and nobody really held us accountable for it. And try to document. In 2010, I was part of a small initiative to document the enforceably disappeared people who disappeared in the 80s. So usually Human Rights Watch annual report, Amnesty International annual report, talk about 17,000 Syrians that disappeared from the 80s. They were detainees, and then they disappeared. And when I started investigating this, I had a trip to Geneva to the Human Rights Council, and I met with the working group on the enforceably or involuntarily disappeared people. Only 8 cases were documented with the UN. So the mission we had in 2010 to increase that number from 8 to 200, to force the UN to list Syria next to Lebanon and Algeria, a country had a practice and history of disappearing people, and ask them about the whereabouts of those people. And after 3 decades of the incident, it was impossible to collect evidence. Most of the witnesses were gone. Most of the people, the evidence. So we managed to collect 35 cases in a course of a year, and the UN accepted 17 only out of this 35. So it's impossible to document after time, and we have enough documentation during the conflict because of the technology, social media, mobile phones. Syria became one of the best documented conflicts. So we have a lot of evidence. So try to preserve this from getting it lost or damaged or tampered with, and put it in one place in a clear methodology. Try to help the people who's doing this work inside Syria. So what we work in our documentation, we're building a database, comprehensive database, that document all the violations in Syria. Government, rebels, third parties like Hezbollah or other external militias, foreign fighters, anybody committing a violation, we document that. And our documentation include videos, images, testimonies from victims, list of perpetrators, list of dead people, list of wounded people, along with physical documents we've been smuggling out of the country from the intelligence agencies that falling under rebel hands. We have 200,000 papers so far, or pages, we scanned from government agencies. And that's telling you about which unit was in charge of the city in this time, who was in charge in that area. And these are significantly important for individual criminal responsibility. Try to demonstrate the chain of command, who was in charge, who ordered what, and who was there, and how the government was acting. And of course, you can get to the systematic nature of these activities from the size or the magnitude of the violations, but as well as from these documents showing the government deploying special troops or special forces to go to a city, besiege the city, and bomb them and deprive them. So that's one component of our work. During our work in the database, we work with other groups who's doing these documentations because it's impossible to cover the one organization that cover the country. There's lots of groups doing this, and we had a year and a half backlog because we started later. So lots of groups we share data with, we take data from their work, and we try to influence the documentation process. Basically, lots of the groups who did documentation or been doing documentation in Syria, they either were activists before the uprising or just a new activist, nested groups that just jump to the field to do the work. But over the course of 3 years, lots of people died, lots of people got arrested, lots of people left the country, and lots of people really no longer believe of justice, of the international justice, because it's been 3 years, they used chemical weapons against civilians, and nobody following the government to stop them. So lots of people just lost their interest in doing documentation and lost the faith that this documentation will lead to some place. So they quit the work. And that made lots of pressure and more tense pressure on the others who left in the field. What we try to do is to support in the methodology, planning, which kind of documentation we collect, and try to help the groups organizing their data, provide them with software. Currently, we're doing risk assessment on the data collection, and we'll be sharing it with other groups, as well as the chain of custody. When you give me a paper or a video, how you get it, from whom, and how it ended up with you, and where it ended up, because you have to demonstrate this to a court for your evidence to be admissible in a court of law. And these knowledge and skills, most of Syrian groups lack this knowledge because we rely on international experts to help us doing it. We have the access, we have the resources. We're supported by 40 countries so far, 8 of them doing financial support, but the 40 countries, lots of political support and expertise. The second thing we do, and here where we overlap with other groups in the international or in the criminal justice sector or aspect, we work to prepare the country for the transition. And here, the term transitional justice. Because lots of countries and conflict had justice mechanism, had tribunals, but the society did not really heal back. So people are not talking to each other, they did not get over what's happened, the victims were not redressed in any certain way, and still there's a culture of impunity. And there's really bad cases of transition, like Lebanon, when the government brought the parliament and they issued a decree saying, okay, amnesty for the crimes in the past 15 years, we're clear. So most of the militia leaders became members of parliaments and ministers in the government, and you have 100,000 people disappeared in the world, nobody knows about. No compensation, no try to redress or attempts to redress the victims or any form of justice to the country. So what we envision in the transitional justice process, and this from previous countries and state practices, 4 or 5 elements. One, of course, the tribunals or the criminal justice. The second one is reparation programs and compensation programs for the victims. And the third one is institutional reform. And under the institutional reform, there's lots of work falling there. It's as important as possible, important as to the criminal justice. We talk about vetting and lustration mechanisms, and basically vet the people who's in the public sector, who committed the crime. If you don't have enough evidence to send them behind bars, you get them out of the public system because they will be running for offices and they will be holding offices that's important in the country. And vetting and lustration is a long mechanism. So you cannot do it in a way that fire everybody out of the government in a bad way like the U.S. government did in Iraq, the de-Ba'athification. Anybody belonged to Al-Ba'ath ruling party was kicked out of the system, and that collapsed the government because you don't have people in the government, you don't have people who knows how to do the daily bureaucratic work of the government. And these mechanisms should be taken in 2 or 3 generations. And other form of alternative or complementary mechanisms to criminal justice is the truth commissions. Try to set up the truth about what happened in the country. And this is very important because the country doesn't know its truth, cannot really be in a good reconcile with its past. So currently there's 2 versions or 3 versions of the truth. The government has its own version. The rebels have their own versions. The neighboring countries have their own versions. And it's very difficult to have one unified version of the truth. And here, where documentation work is very critical. So our documentation was tailored or expanded in a way that we do not document only evidence for criminal justice, but we document information that's necessary for truth commissions. And so let's imagine you have a truckload of papers. Not all of it will be admissible in a court of law. The court will take 2, 3, 4, 10 files, but at the end we don't trash them. Those will be a good starting point for truth commissions. So that's why we document for truth commissions. We document for institutional reform. We document for reparation and compensations. And we document for memorialization events. Basically, the activities of memorializing what happened to bring the nation to become more aware about what's happened, to prevent the repeatance of such actions. And of course, institutional reform has lots of work under it. Part of it is disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of forces. So imagine you have two groups of fighters that have been fighting each other for 1,200 days, and then you tell them you're going to become one army to work together and to have one unified agenda. That's impossible work. So part of it as well, vetting the rebels who committed and the fighters who committed violation, get them out of the system and bring the good actors, and quote good actors because this is going to be very relatively speaking, and bring them to become part of the unified nation, army or military. Security sector reform. How are we going to reform the security sector agencies? All the countries have intelligence work, but they do not violate citizen rights. And that's try to train these agencies and apparatus to do the right work without abusing the people. And of course, it's all long-term activities. And here are the challenges and difficulties. From one hand, you have a nation with 9 million IDPs or refugees. So 2 to 3 million, 2.4 million, according to the UNHCR, are refugees in the neighboring country. 6 to 7 million are internally displaced people inside their country. But the total of 9.3 million, they need a daily food assistance or they will die. And you have to tell those people, here's all the luxury about the international criminal justice and here's about the theories we learned in the law schools, let's apply it on you. And here's the difficulties. You have a nation that traumatized significantly and people who's looking all for their daily need of food and protecting their children and shelter and medication, and they're not really be able to absorb this. If you delay these practices, so there's no quick justice mechanism, people will turn to revenge. Because if you're not establishing a tribunal quickly, I'm not going to watch you walk in the street and you killed my son. I'm going to kill you. So you have to take immediate action to contain that practice and tendency to go to revenge without really sacrificing the due process and do the right work and in the right way to engage with the system. And these mechanisms must be, and a big must, consultative process with the nation. If you do not consult Syrians about it, they're going to boycott the transition plan. And it's going to be a major failure. And that happened in lots of countries before. And if you consult them, there's a big part of the society, or relatively good part of the society, will end up dissatisfied from this process. Because they are families of perpetrators, though it's not their best interest to see their boys and sons behind bars. Or they will be vetted and kicked out of the public sector, so it's not best interest for them to join the institutional reform mechanism. It's not in their best interest to do a truth commission about what's happened in the government practice in the past 3 or 4 decades, because that's going to take lots of benefits from lots of people who benefited from the system in different ways that was illegal and unfair. And here where the difficulties lays down. So lots of people will be dissatisfied. And the right thing to do during the conflict is to manage people's expectations. So all the victims, for example, they expect perpetrators to be held accountable behind bars. Every single perpetrator. That's not going to happen. Everybody expecting a compensation because they were victimized. Because they were killed or tortured or displaced from their city or became refugees or lost their jobs or university or anything. That's not going to happen. Everybody think any perpetrator who committed a violation will be out of the system. That's not going to happen. So try to manage the expectation of people and try to find that very difficult balance between transition and moving forward and keeping the country up and running on the right path without sacrificing the justice as a big and important element of a democratic country that people were heading toward in their uprising. So we need a justice, but justice not for everybody. A little bit tailored justice that contain only the big perpetrators accountable and others subject to other alternative mechanism of justice, truth commission, restoration, vetting, etc. And the most important thing is how to convince Syrians that this is the right way to do it. Most of Syrians now, especially with the conflict heading toward sectarian background a little bit, and with Shia militias coming from Iraq and Iran fighting, and Sunni foreign fighters coming to fight next to the rebels. And that added more fuel and complexity to the already complicated conflict. How to convince Syrians that it's not the Alawite who are killing you on a systematic Alawite agenda. Otherwise, Alawite is a small Muslim sect, belong to the Shia group, and the president belongs to this minority group, Alawite. How to convince the 70% Sunnis of the state that you were not subject to a campaign of killing merely because you were Sunnis and because they are Alawite. And how to convince the people that, well, we have a reparation program, but we don't have money to pay all of you. Of course, all this will come after the conflict ends, at least after the fire season starts at any point. And there's another difficult question, because when you come to the international justice of mechanism, so one of the questions I got one of our donors, that the Swedish government, we're in the record, any of your documentation will lead to a death penalty? And I said, no, I don't know. I'm not sure. I cannot answer now, because that's up to the tribunal, not to me. I'm documenting only. And here there's lots of questions. Who gonna fund the tribunal? So the EU and the UN refrained from funding Iraq tribunal because of the death penalty, because of the lack of due process. Only the US and the Kuwait and the Saudis, I think, funded Saddam Hussein tribunal. If we want to get lots of funding for this tribunal, we have to sacrifice some of our demands. And Syrians demanding for death penalty because they think the president and his inner circle really deserve a death penalty. And that's created another hostility with the international justice mechanism. Basically, we don't like the UN. You left us being killed for 3 years, and now, guys, you want to hijack our tribunal to take Bashar al-Assad to a maximum 14 years of prison in a five-star hotel in The Hague. And that's not going to happen. We aren't going to imprison him here. And, of course, what's happening in the region, you cannot isolate Syria from it. There's a problem between the ICC and the Libyan government over Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi, the son of the Gaddafi, the leader of Libya. There's a problem with the domestic and the national prosecutors in Egypt who set Hosni Mubarak free and they imprisoned the elected president. So lots of precedents, it's not really encouraging Syrians to go on the justice path, but rather telling them, kill him in the spot if you capture him, that's the best way to do it, and otherwise it's going to be highly cost, and lots of people will intervene to tell you, don't do this, that's international human rights law, and you cannot do that. And honestly, you're talking about traumatized nation. Every time we talk to refugees, I go to southern Turkey a lot. We talk to lots of refugees. My brother himself is a refugee in southern Turkey. And when you talk to them about transitional justice, about planning for truth commissions, people laugh about it because, you know what, I want to feed my children. So tell me something more realistic. Or tell me that I have to be tolerant toward the idea who killed me are free because we don't have sufficient evidence. There's no sufficient evidence. Any real tribunal with a fair and international standards respecting the due process will set them free. And that's adding lots of challenges. Who's going to fund? And the funds will come when the reconstruction of Syria will become political fund. And that's going to be conditional with lots of things, with guarantees toward the minorities in Syria, including the Alawites, who the victims doesn't like to hear a lot, and the international community keep repeating, with lots of money going to the tribunal. For example, Rwanda tribunal, which is a hybrid tribunal, costed $245 million. So if we have $245 million and we have seven provinces destroyed to the level, you have to build them from scratch, everything. And you put the victims and ask them which one you would pick. Build your house and give you a life back, build your school, or spend the money on the people who already destroyed the city just to put them behind bars. So people might tend to award really bad conclusions, like let's kill them because it's cheaper, and then we use the money and we put it in the system. If you imprison them, where are you going to imprison them? It's not secure to hold them inside Syria. Who's the court will be in charge of this? How many people you can imprison? In Libya, they arrested 12,000. How much? 11?
8,000.
8,000 from Gaddafi. So from Gaddafi's son to the food soldiers who were in the checkpoint. How are you going to feed them? They're going to cost you a lot of money. You spend it on repairing the programs and paying the victims, try to treat some of the children who was victimized and traumatized, or spend it on the perpetrators' food and security and prison. So lots of questions to be the Syrians to be consulted at, and they are not consulted. That's a big problem here. Lots of international proposals. They jump to say, Balkis mentioned briefly, there's some stories going on inside the U.S. to set up a hybrid tribunal in Syria, with a court or a tribunal statutes in English, never translated into Arabic. No Syrians aware about it. So the Americans will do it with their international experts, and the Syrians are the audience here. And those audience will tend to become violators to this plan if you do not really respect their victimization and talk to them ahead of time. So I'll stop here, because if you want to go through this, it's a lot of challenges and difficulties, but it's realistic of what's happening in Syria, away from what's written in the text box. Because victim doesn't understand the text box and what's going on there. And part of the work we do on the transitional justice, briefly, we refrain from doing prescribed plans, pre-prescribed plans, saying, okay, we set up a hybrid tribunal and then we compensate 10%, or then we build 10 cities and then the plan is great. And we do not do that because it's impossible to consult people, and it's bad if you do not consult them. So the right thing to do is to document for the transitional justice, not only for the tribunal as we've been doing, but to document for truth commissions, institutional reform, reparation program, and memorialization events as well. And to tell Syrians about these questions, try to educate the public opinion about this, what's happening, and tell them that the money will be very little. You rather spend it on the people or the children who's victim of polio, who's according to the UNICEF 80,000 children, or spend it on the people who killed them or who besieged them to prevent the vaccine going to them. So you have to ask the people about this. So we don't prescribe plans. We try to make the people aware of the transitional justice alternatives available to them and try to advise them about, because unless the fighting is really get to end, I don't think anybody will be able to make a wise, informed, good decision for their future. And trying to bring some Syrians and try to agree with them in a specific nature of justice during the conflict is bad, as bad as leaving the conflict without accountability at all. I'll stop here, and we're open to the Q&A and the discussion.
Thank you both. Yes, let's just open it. And I'm going to ask you to limit your comments, please. Yes.
Thank you so much. There's a lot here. None of it's happy, but thank you for the clarity that you brought. I have a lot of questions. One is, perhaps both of you have talked about international organizations and then sort of the role of different nations.
Would you repeat, because the recording?
Sure. So you both talked about international cooperation. I'm just wondering if you see any particular role for sort of regional organizations in the countries that are close geographically and also in some ways culturally or linguistically to Syria, if you see some particular role for regional nations and groups sort of in collaboration possibly with the international community.
Do you want to take a couple
of questions?
Yeah, and then we address them. Yeah. That's more efficient.
Hi, guys. I was wondering if you think there's, if you can identify kind of a civil war or civil struggle in another part of the world or in the region that was done, you know, the justice after the struggle was done particularly well or could be used as a model for the Syrian struggle. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I wanted to ask something that follows kind of specifically on that, which is what lessons do you draw from the Egyptian experience with trials? And do you sort of reject the idea altogether that the trials were playing a role in the military sort of resurgence in that country?
Mm-hmm.
Should we take those three or do you want to
take them? I'll take the last one there, all the way back.
Yes, I was curious. Do you think when the Chemical Weapons Act occurred that there should have been a red line drawn in the sand that once that was crossed, international action should have been taken forth?
Do you want to start?
Just to start with the last question first, when you say international action, am I understanding military action? Just to say that actually falls outside of our mandate at Human Rights Watch, and we don't take a position on military intervention. So I'll punt that to Mohammed.
To most of Syrians, yes. And it should have happened earlier than that, because according to the statistics, like 1,000 or 1,400 people who died in the chemical attack is less than 1% of the total death on the conventional arms. And if you look at the politics, how played around the chemical attack, so the U.S. threat to strike on the Syrian government, and the Russians said, we're not going to defend you. Go at your own. And that forced the Syrian government to sign the convention on the prohibition of developing, producing, or using chemical weapons, and quickly turn to the UN to deliver their chemical arsenal. So a credible threat of using power without using it was enough to stop some certain activities and get certain outcomes. And if that was used earlier, yes, that would have prevented lot of these crimes. And so when I remember when our center started, so the idea of deterrence coming from the accountability mechanisms is not really a successful idea. It's not a successful theory. You cannot really deter a perpetrator, a war criminal, simply by saying, hey, we're documenting everything. When you get to the end, we're going to hold you accountable. So we have to prevent you from doing those to the best of our capacity, and then hold you accountable for what you did. And there's lots of previous examples happened in different countries. So in Libya, when the Security Council referred Libya case to the ICC at the beginning of the conflict, that did not prevent Gaddafi from going forward and kill people and commit horrible crimes. So the fact or the idea of I don't accept it, honestly, the deterrence by threatening of accountability. You should do something better. And here, I'll go there from the to the it's all related questions actually. No regional country that can contribute positively to the conflict, unfortunately. Most of the Gulfy countries contributing to the conflict in a bad way, supplying arms and dividing the opposition between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. We rejected funds from one of the governments in Gulf, our organization, because we want to maintain some standards. And Turkey is not a big fan of the ICC because they had a massacre against the Armenian population in 1915. And Israel is a big violator of international humanitarian law, international criminal law themselves against the Palestinians and the settlements. So lots of neighboring countries, it's not their best interest, neither the Arab countries, to see a successful transition plan in one of the countries, because that might encourage their own population to go and rise against these governments. So the Saudis helping Syrians, but not really optimistic about if the result was good, that would encourage Saudis to do it in Saudi Arabia. Same with Qatar, same with Emirates, etc. So I don't see a regional power playing. So I hope the League of Arab States will do something, but it was highly disabled agency and it's not doing anything. And we hope that the Islamic cooperation organization would do something, who attended both our meeting when we established our organization. They showed lots of political support for documentation. But when you talk to any one of the neighboring countries and tell them, hey, we want to smuggle these papers through your border, so help us, and they block you unless they take access to these papers. And we cannot give you access because we're playing with the admissibility of evidence if we share it with any government. So our database is blocked. Nobody would look at it unless there's a specific and a credible justice mechanism in place. On similar conflict, I'm not sure if I get the question correctly. That was your question. I think what happened... So your question was a similar conflict in the world happened similar to Syria now?
Do you think there's ever been a credible justice after the fact that we could use as kind of a model?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is very relative because some places successful, but successful comparing to other places. But comparing to a pure justice, I don't think there's 100% successful justice. And Balfaiz can weigh in here a lot more than me. But I think there's some areas. Now, in Cambodia, there were International Criminal Tribunal in Cambodia that did a good work after 30 years. Now, in Guatemala, there's a genocide tribunal, and which is... So, and here the question will become is the best of the possible. So that's the most we can get. That's the optimum of what we can get now, which is better than nothing. And that's why the other alternatives of truth commissions and compensations are another option that people can take. We did a study recently, our report, and thank you, Professor, for printing the report. Thank you. It's 46 in-depth interviews with Syrians inside the country and refugee camps. Asking them about these questions. Do you want justice, or do you want to be compensated, or do you want the people who committed the violations to be killed, or what's the deal? And we get mixed answers. So we interviewed non-activists from either side, that's average people, and we interviewed from both sides in different communities, liberated areas or rebel-held areas and regime-held areas. And we get different answers here because everybody understanding of justice is just different, depends on their circumstances. For the refugees, they want to go back. If the trade-off, there's no trials, but Assad is out, it's fine. And of course, there's international politics around this, and here we go back to the UN and to the US. The negotiation was happening in Geneva, the second round of negotiation. Let's assume the international community agreed with Assad in a mechanism that they give him exit out of the country, but there's a commitment, there's no trials against him if he leaves the country. I think most Syrians will be happy to see that result as a way to end the war. But is that a satisfying justice way? Absolutely not. So you have to scale it all together, not as you let the... What the society, and I'm doing some research about how many tribunals happened in the world and how many resources were dedicated to them versus how many resources were dedicated for truth commissions and other activities. And what was that money used in a good way and resources to heal the societies? Not necessarily if you had an international tribunal and did a good work and put people behind bars, that the society will go back to function in the way that was prior to the conflict. In Bosnia and Yugoslavia, we ended up splitting the country to 7 nations to get rid of that, despite the fact there's an international tribunal for Yugoslavia. So the justice is not only the court, to my understanding, but would people go back to their life and function similar to what was the case before the conflict?
I just wanted to add a couple of points to a few things that you said. On deterrence, I tend to agree with you, Mohammed, that the mere fact that you're documenting crimes or you're conducting investigations, I don't think is enough to put in the mind of a perpetrator or a would-be perpetrator that they should think twice. And I think that's really what's driving us to insert a concrete accountability mechanism into this picture in Syria, and it just doesn't exist. I mentioned there's a UN panel, it's called the Commission of Inquiry. It's been mandated by the Human Rights Council in Geneva to also document crimes in Syria, and they've published about 7 reports, in-depth reports, about the types of abuses that are taking place there. But it's become almost business as usual, just another report. The last report that they published, they were very explicit and said very plainly in the report that, the individuals in Syria, they just don't fear being held accountable, and so they're able to act with impunity. It's very hard to prove that a judicial mechanism or a court, a tribunal, whatever, has a deterrent effect. On the other hand, we have seen some signs of that in various situations. Mohammed, you mentioned Libya. What you said is true. On the other hand, it gives a chance to talk about a situation that the Security Council did refer to the International Criminal Court. And as you say, they did it very early. The conflict there started February 15th, 2011, and by February 26th, the ICC was involved. And what we saw afterward was an uptick in defections from the regime once the court was involved. And so the people surrounding Gaddafi and surrounding his regime, the number just decreased. And they were even leaving the country itself. So I think, there is some evidence.
Wasn't that because of the NATO campaign? Because we're going to lose anyway, the NATO is involved. And let's get out here quickly and get some deal.
Yeah, the NATO campaign came
later,
yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And just to the question of the regional organizations, I agree with everything that you've said about the divisions and the fact that they're actually, the countries in the region are playing quite a negative role and having a negative impact. And the Arab League is quite divided. And of course, there's an issue of complicity, a fear that are we going to see ourselves in front of some kind of a court? I'm going to take us out of the region for a second. There's another commission of inquiry that just published a report, a UN panel on North Korea. And in that report, China was mentioned very prominently as bearing some responsibility for what's happening in North Korea. And I think everyone agrees that basically will be the end of that report as far as whether it leads to any kind of a concrete accountability measure. So I think we can see the same thing.
We missed a question on the Egypt, maybe?
Yeah.
You wanna?
I can't say.
I mean, it's still what's going on in Egypt is did not really came to an end. So you learn lessons, but what people learn in neighboring countries is that if you capture your leader, just kill them on the spot because the military will come and release them. And of course, I'm saying this in a sarcastic way, but people in Syria, for example, doesn't really believe holding anybody accountable inside the country is a possible option. And Balqis did mention about the domestic, the national prosecution will not be sufficient. It was not really a good and independent and impartial judiciary prior to the conflict. It is definitely not during the conflict, and it will not be after the conflict. So that's some of the lessons learned. And of course, could be in the political side what the political parties did, try to manipulate the power themselves alone without sharing with others. And it's the one lesson learned is positive one, that you cannot really repeat what happened prior to the conflict with the people. So bring a government and start making amendments to the constitution, giving the president exclusive powers to do whatever, overruling the Supreme Court, overruling everybody, and people will rise again against you. That was a good practice from the people, except that it brought the military back in Egypt, and now the head of the military tried to run for presidency. Do you want to say something?
Do you want to add something? I was going to add something, but unrelated to what you just said, because it reminded me of something you were talking about earlier. While we're on Libya, and obviously that is a part of my work as well. What we've seen there, and Mohammed, you alluded to that, as far as the national prosecutions, the ICC is involved there. There are two suspects, one of which is the son of the former Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, and the other was his military chief, Abdullah Sanusi. Both of them are in custody in Libya, and the Libyans have challenged the ICC's jurisdiction, which they can do under the ICC's treaty, to say, actually, we're going to try them. We have them in our custody, and we're going to do it for the same case as the ICC. And, you know, they have to go through a process to show that it is the same case and that they're able and willing to do that. But the advantage of this, I mean, in an ideal, if it turns out well, which the jury is still out, it's sort of forcing the Libyan authorities to meet certain standards to take back those cases, so that they may not end up as show trials. We'll see. So, you know, while there is a tension between the international and the national system, you can see that there can be a synergy and some advantages to both being involved at the same time.
Let's take a few more questions.
Thank you for speaking today. You mentioned earlier that since the ICC is not involved in Syria, that there might be other alternatives, and you also mentioned the U.S. is considering an ad hoc risk commission thing. Would you consider something like that a viable alternative, or do you have any other ideas about what you mentioned that the Human Rights Watch is trying to do something on? So I guess, are there any other viable alternatives?
I just have one question, which is, so you talk about a transitional justice strategy whereby the Syrians themselves would be in charge and involved in terms of making and designing the strategy, which seems very sensible. I just wonder, do you have any thoughts on how to protect the allied minority in that case? So how are you going to protect that minority from the majority? And it seems that maybe a transition, a democratic transition and a regime change may be easier to achieve if there's some assurances for protection of the ally, even if you want like to prosecute the most egregious human rights offenders. But I mean, I think this is a real human rights concern in case of the regime.
Had one here, maybe?
Question is pretty similar to the first question, but how is the U.S. relationship with the ICC and the Rome Statute, how does that affect its one ability to put pressure on the Security Council to give a mandate or its non-ability to do so?
It's your area, but please, but I'll jump to answer this quickly and then you correct me if I say something.
Okay, no problem.
Because the U.S. doesn't like the ICC, the U.S. is not going forward to propose it to the Security Council. As an idea at the beginning. And the Russians are going to veto it. Okay, propose it, have the Russians veto it, and then they will be blamed for it publicly in the eyes of everybody. What the Security Council did, a great thing in the previous Security Council resolution and the humanitarian access to Syria that's passed in a month ago almost, they used the Sochi Olympic event because Russia was trying to, during the Olympic Games, zero bad media on Russia. So they try to hold everything quiet and nice and play nice so they don't get bad media during the Olympic Games. And here were the other groups, Human Rights Watch and others, jump to some Security Council countries saying, hey, propose a resolution draft that condemned both sides' violations and ask both sides to comply and open humanitarian access. The Russians couldn't veto that. So that's one thing. And when the balance of the power will change in Syria, and the rebels defeat more the government, and the rebels commit more violations, and the Alawite community will be, and the Christians will be threatened by some violations by the rebels, it's in Russia's interest to refer Syria to the ICC, because now it serves their political goal more than the U.S. But still nobody proposing it. The U.S. refraining from doing that, discouraging countries who's doing this, and keep telling Syrians, ah, it's a bad thing, don't do it, it's going to hold only 5 people accountable. And hey, let's do a hybrid tribunal, international tribunal, before the ICC thing, so we roll it out off. The Foreign Relations Committee in the Congress, in the House, they did a hearing about Syria, about hybrid tribunal in Syria. Somebody from Human Rights Watch participated there, but no Syrians were there. They did not consult with Syrians about it, and automatically, because the congressman doesn't like the ICC, he said, well, the ICC is not an option because we need a Security Council resolution, despite the fact a hybrid tribunal needs similar Security Council resolution. It's not going to pass automatically. You need the same mechanism. So rolling off one because we don't like it, and here, again, referring to Balqis' comment about the Arab League and the international community in general, they fear to have a precedent where the international community came to end or suspend a membership of state in the UN or referring them to a special court without a Security Council mandate, maybe under the General Assembly mandate, because that could be repeated again in another conflict, and they themselves might be the subject here. And that's why the U.S. is not really going forward with the ICC. So correct me if...
No, I mean, everything that you've said is correct. You know, what we're saying is that, you know, we don't expect them to propose the measure necessarily, but take a principled stance. You know, you have, when you have over 60 countries supporting this measure, when there is no justice, when there are 9 out of 15 Security Council members supporting it, where is the U.S. voice? Especially since it can be such a powerful one, and it might galvanize its allies to, as I said, put more pressure. But not only are they not taking a principled stance, but I'd say that behind the scenes, from what we understand, they're actually doing things that are counterproductive. So I mentioned there were 2 resolutions at the UN Security Council on Syria, one on chemical weapons, the other one on humanitarian access. An early draft of the chemical weapons resolution that was drafted, I believe, by the UK or France, one of those two, I don't remember, included a reference to the ICC. And in the way that negotiations work at the Security Council is that a smaller group of countries that are drafting the resolution sort of agree on the text, and then they propose it to the larger council. And in that small group that the United States was involved in, they asked explicitly, from what we understand about those negotiations, that the ICC be taken out. So the draft wasn't even proposed to the Russians with the ICC in it, so that they, you know, they weren't even putting them in an uncomfortable spot. Most likely they would have said, we won't agree to this resolution unless you take the ICC out. But they were saved by the bell, so to speak, by the United States. As far as the question about what alternatives are there and the ad hoc ideas that the U.S. And others are proposing or toying with, there are different options. There's an ad hoc tribunal like the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda. Those two were actually set up via the Security Council through a Security Council resolution. So you don't really get around the political dynamics at the Security Council setting up that kind of a tribunal. And then you have more of a hybrid or mixed. The special court for Sierra Leone is an example of that. But in that case, the government of Sierra Leone itself asked for that to be set up, and we don't have that situation here in Syria. The Syrian government isn't going to ask for that to happen. So while we don't oppose an alternate mechanism, I think there are real questions about the financial, the practical, the political feasibility of setting something up. You already have an existing mechanism, and obviously it takes time to set up an institution from scratch, years potentially. So, you know, all those considerations have to be taken into account. And as Mohammed mentioned, the Syrians obviously need to be involved in that process.
One quick answer on the alloy thing, because that's a very important question. The protection to the any minority is their participation of the transition plan. So anybody who will boycott this transition plan will complain later and saying, well, we were not included and our interests were not really protected. So coming forward and participating in the planning for the transition, for the trials, and be open for the justice idea. So do not expect your sons to form a militias armed by the government civilians and terrified like 7 or 8 provinces and committed most sexual violence was committed by those civilians more than the military. And then in the bargaining, we should say, well, yeah, forget it. We're not going to hold you accountable. You're okay. That's not going to happen. So the protection for the Alawite is to be open to the justice idea, to the individuals individually who committed these crimes. Of course, we have evidence on them. Honestly, the other alternative will be the country will hold them accountable as a sect and as a group collectively about what's happened. And that's the bad thing we're trying to avoid by encouraging the Alawite community to say something about what's happening in the country. Condemn the chemical attacks. So the Alawite community held a protest and happiness protest, and they were like cheering for the chemical attack and asking the government to do it again in their cities and area. And that's not a good sign. Till a 70% Sunni majority in the country, and the government going to an end sooner or later, because there's no way the government will be back to rule the country prior to March 12, 11. So they're not helping us, helping them. So they're doing everything counterproductive to protect them. And of course, the international community using the protection of minorities, Alawite and Christians, namely, as a justification, try to say, yeah, well, we did not act because we have concerns about the protection of minorities, the government fault. So basically telling the majority of the country, well, we're not protecting you of the killing because we have fear or concerns that if you might survive, you might think about harming the minorities. And that's holding the minorities accountable indirectly. So the nation telling them, we would not really have any rescue or any support or stopping of this war because other countries were interested more on protecting you rather than protecting the citizens and the human rights in general, or the humans in general. Ironically, Russia proposed an urgent Security Council session to protect the minorities, the Armenian minority in Kasab, in the coastal area, where the rebels been fighting the last 2 weeks, and they did some good progress. Versus for 3 years blocked any resolution that talking about merely condemning the violations happening. And these actions are, Syrians are not really blind. They watch this very clearly and they know what's happening, and that's not a good and productive measurements to be added to the transition. Of course, and the allies themselves will be very naive if they believe any verbal protections, like commitments. Like, hey, we promise you if things went the way we like, we're not going to do anything. If they believe that, they'll be naive, because they know there's a huge violation committed by their civilians, the militias. And that's why coming forward and be part of the transition and be part, and the fact about truth commissions is it's going to be representative from all the country, sects and backgrounds and groups, minority groups, women, children, fighters, representative, of course, of these groups, militias, and try to have a committee that really represents the nation to bring one version of the truth together. If they came forward and joined and participated in these transition plans, I think that's the best guarantee for them. Otherwise, all the people who are promising them NTVs are just lying to them, quite honestly.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
That's completely different? I wanted to ask about a gender approach to transitional justice strategy, particularly for Syria. So most of the time, transitional justice talks about civil and political rights, and I think this past hour is a pretty good description of that. And of course, the Rome Statute has really done a good job of incorporating gender-based violence as a war crime or crimes against humanity. So thinking about transitional justice in terms of its sort of institutional reform category, how are people thinking about redress for economic, social, and cultural rights? And, you know, for example, the impoverishment of people, the fact that women may be combatants, but after the fighting, after the guns fall silent, they may not be able to benefit from any kind of demobilization or reintegration strategies. And also where violence against women is considered, where sexual violence is considered an honor crime, how will violence against women be dealt with in the aftermath in a society that has those kinds of approaches?
It's a difficult question, so I'll throw it in.
I'm joking.
No. In general, two things. One, we document any sexual and gender-based violence happening. So it's very difficult to get these stories and to get testimonies from victims, because victims in a relatively conservative society don't come forward to tell you the stories about what's happened. And, of course, there's lots of fake stories from both sides. The government telling everybody, well, the rebels are raping the civilians. And the rebels use that to increase the rage among the fighters, saying, hey, they're raping our daughters and wives, let's do this, let's fight them, let's jihad on them, let's call foreign fighters. So both sides use it in a bad way. Of course, there's good precedents, and there's the ICC and the Sudan indictment, the Bashir indictment, mentioned rape as a weapon of war. That was a case there in the case of Sudan. But so far, the concern is, honestly, it's not about the documentation of it only, but about how to redress them after. Because if they don't tell you they're victims, you cannot do anything. So we try to bring some stories from different state practices or previous conflicts where hiding the fact of you being victim did not really help you a lot. And that's happened in Bosnia significantly, because the forced pregnancy and the rape cases were significant there. And the woman had to be pregnant and deliver those babies, and then they tell them, well, your dad died in the war. And then they raise them till a couple of 20 or something, and then eventually the kids will know that they were born after a rape case. But there's very, very little cases that brought to international justice. And to one case was in the Sabra and Shatila camp in Lebanon, where the militias raped Lebanese militias raped Palestinian ladies. There's one after 17 years came and spoke about what happened with her, and she went to Brussels and she went to UK because there's five countries have international legal jurisdiction, but that did not end up anywhere. So it's very very little cases. What we do in the transitional justice, and that was one of the questions here, and we try to prepare a similar study talking about women experience in the war and how we can redress those. But very little number willing to talk, and they deny the fact they were victims at any point, so they don't tell you the true story or the full story, so you cannot really measure what's going to happen. The International Rescue Committee, IRC, is doing soon a report on the women experience in the war of Syria, but beyond being victimized for rape and sexual violence, female and women really participated significantly in the revolution. In the protest and the leadership of one of the best documentation group, VDC, Violation Documentation Center, the lawyer who set up this is a female lawyer. She's kidnapped now by the rebel group, unfortunately by one of the rebel groups, not by the government. So acknowledging the fact they were part of this and they played a role, a big role, beyond that they became victims and we have to bear the burden of hiding them or fix their situation. But they were part of the protest, they were part of the decision-making process. There's two female were in the negotiation in Geneva. So try to give them, and honestly, if they don't come and fight for their rights, nobody volunteered to give them and like any space in the transition plan. But in our thinking about this, there's gender aspect for the documentation, there's gender aspect of engaging people for consulting their opinions about. And of course, women groups are one categorized as one of the vulnerable groups that need to be consulted significantly in any meaningful transition consultation. And that's, I'm not sure if I answered really the question, but it's one of the difficult areas. However, lots of groups or people denying the fact that it's honor crime, and they say, no, it's not, but it's happening, in fact. So even if you're a victim sometime, you might be subject to another victimization. Your family will reject you. Because if you did not protest and went in that crazy protest, nobody will arrest you and rape you, and now we have to carry the burden of being a shamed family because you are a victim of rape. Versus the Commission of Inquiry, Balkis mentioned, in their first report, they mentioned they interviewed lots of refugees who escaped to Turkey, and they said there's a significant rape cases among male in prisons. So the government will rape them using tools, not sexual, by another person. But they were able to talk about it, and the Commission of Inquiry brought that up in the Human Rights Council and made it a big case a little bit in the beginning of the conflict, versus no similar efforts to do it with the females. And I keep track of the interviews happening in media about victims of sexual violence, and I'm not going to say it, who's the TV on the record, but I talked to one of the TVs who published three filmed interviews with female saying they're subject to sexual violence. Of course, covering their identity, filming them from the back, etc. And the reporter themselves tell me, well, this was a fake story, part of the campaign against the Syrian government. And after watching the story and being really touched by what's happened, and the lady crying, and then the reporter telling you, well, we made this up. So the verification and the evidence is very difficult. And here, I refer to Rwanda, the rape cases happened in Rwanda. How many? 2,000 rape cases, at least? 300 only went to the court to tell, hey, we were rape victims, and 8 only cases were reviewed by the court. So the number will be significantly narrowed because of the lack of evidence and lack of documentation upon the time of the violation happened. And we try to raise awareness about it by telling these stories from state practice. If you tell now, it's better to preserve your rights than waiting later to other brave woman will come forward and say, hey, I was a victim, and then you join the same case, because clearly there will be no evidence here.
Do you want to say anything? Maybe one of the things that's needed is different strategies for documentation. You know, just the collecting the stories is not going to work because they won't come forward. Then there might have to be different ways.
We have full-time staff inside Syria that collect information for us and coordinate with other groups. And part of the training we're providing them is social training on how to talk to victims. So if you want to capture the story of a victim, don't traumatize them again. So there's some certain techniques you have to be aware. Of course, we're not reaching a level of counseling for victims, but at least be aware. And part of it, indeed, when talk to a sexual and gender-based violence victims, how to talk to them. But it's really difficult unless you come in a campaign And that's opposition news a lot, saying, well, they raped this amount of girls, and so we cannot tolerate or not talk about revenge or doing that. Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, so I want to thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
People can ask questions. They'll be around for a few more minutes. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.